I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
Love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more? Check out my podcast. Hi, I'm Kadra, the host of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. I tell tales every single week that have left me perplexed. You'll hear true crime cases, mysterious disappearances, learn about cults, hear baffling sightings of cryptids, chilling paranormal encounters, and even dark and weird history. I release new episodes every Wednesday, and you can listen anywhere podcasts are available. I'm also on Patreon, and you can even watch me on YouTube. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. Stories that will leave you perplexed.
You are listening to Perplexity.
Though we need to weep your loss, you dwell in that safe place in our hearts, where no storm or night or pain can reach you. Your love was like the dawn, brightening over our lives, awakening beneath the dark, a further adventure of color. The sound of your voice found for us a new music that brightened everything. Whatever you enfolded in your gaze, quickened in the joy of its being. You placed smiles like flowers on the altar of the heart. Your mind always sparkled with wonder at things. Though your days here were brief, your spirit was live, awake, complete. We look towards each other no longer. From the old distance of our names, now you dwell inside the rhythm of breath. As we close to us as we are to ourselves, though we cannot see you with outward eyes, we know our soul's gaze is upon your face, smiling back at us from within everything, to which we bring our best refinement. Let us not look for you only in memory, where we would grow lonely without you. You would want us to find you in presence, beside us, when beauty brightens, when kindness glows, and music echoes eternal tones. When orchids brighten the earth, darkest winter has turned to spring. May this dark grief flower with hope in every heart that loves you. May you continue to inspire us to enter each day with a generous heart, to serve the call of courage and love until we see your beautiful face again. In that land where there is no more separation, where all tears will be wiped from our mind, and where we will never lose you again. On the Death of the Beloved, a poem by John O'Donohue. On the chilly night of February 24th, 1978, a group of five close-knit friends living in Yuba City, California, would go to a Chico basketball game. 24-year-old Jackie Charles Hewitt, 29-year-old William or Bill Lee Sterling, 32-year-old Theodore or Ted Earl Weir, 30-year-old Jack Doc Antone Madruga, and 25-year-old Gary Dale Mathias would leave a basketball game at a local university in Chico. It seemed like a typical night for the five friends, who their family lovingly referred to as the boys. But this night would become the anniversary of their nightmare, the day their lives would change forever. No definitive evidence has emerged to conclusively determine what happened on that fateful night of February 24th, 1978. This case continues to baffle investigators and captivate the public's imagination, standing as one of the most perplexing missing persons cases in all of American history. Over four decades later, the men's fate remains shrouded in mystery, with many questions still left unanswered. In fact, the more I learned about this case, the more confused I became. In the words of the author Tony Wright, if you're going to research the Yuba County 5 case, you've got to accept the ache of uncertainty. Not knowing is the hardest part. The realization is that for all of the research, the hours of interviews, and the data collected, we will likely never know what happened to those five young men that night. What drove them into the mountains, 70 miles in the wrong direction, amid sub-freezing temperatures, wearing only spring clothes? What then made them abandon the safety of their vehicle and hike further into the wilderness instead of turning around and heading back home? End quote. This is the story of the Yuba County Five, also known as the American Dilatov Pass Incident or the Mathias Group Incident. This is the deep dive, and you are listening to part two. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra, and if you're new here, hello. Thank you so much for tuning in and welcome to the show. If you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you enjoy, be sure to follow along. If you're watching on YouTube, I would love it if you hit the subscribe button. And if you're listening on a podcast and you enjoy, I would love if you left us a 5-star review. This is going to be part two of the deep dive into the Yuba County Five. So if you missed part one, be sure to go back and listen to that. Part three will come out next week, and that is when we'll get into theories surrounding what happened to the five. This part is going to be all about the investigation and some very mysterious sightings of the men. We'll also talk in depth about Joseph Schoen, who we left off on in part one. He is believed to be the only person, or I guess I should say the last person, to have seen the five alive on the night that they disappeared. I want to thank Scott once again, a fellow patron, for requesting this story. And that is one of the benefits for joining the Patreon. You make a request and that request gets moved to the front of the queue. Scott, thank you for requesting this story. Trigger warning for today's episode. This podcast is adult, and we will be going over some disturbing topics, so listener discretion is advised. And as always, all of the sources that were used for today's episode will be down in the show notes. But once again, I want to thank the author, Tony Wright, author of The Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five book, as his book was incredibly helpful to my research and writing these episodes. So without further ado, let's get into the deep dive of The Yuba County Five, Part 2. Chapter 4, Early Days. In Part 1, where we left off, in the Plumas National Forest, it was total darkness, the last place that the Yuba County Five would be seen alive on the night of February 24th, 1978. And they would be seen by a man named Joseph Schoens. Before we talk about Joseph Schoens, I would like to talk about the morning of February 25th. Back in the Yuba City, Marysville area, the families of the five were deeply worried. Their sons had never returned home from the Chico basketball game, and their big basketball tournament was scheduled for later that day. They were supposed to meet up with the rest of the Gateway Gators and their coach, Robert Pinnock, at 8 a.m. at a department store in downtown Marysville, and from there, they would take a bus to Sierra College for their game. Imogene Weir, Ted's mother, was awakened during the early morning hours to a phone call from Juanita Sterling, Bill Sterling's mother. Juanita would inform Imogene that Bill had also not come home that night. Soon, Imogene would also learn that Gary Mathias had never made it home either. And not long after that, they would learn Doc Madruga and Jackie Hewitt shared the same fate. This was incredibly out of character for these five men. They were very strict on routines. Hewitt's parents were especially worried because he had never stayed the night away from home. None of the five had even called, reached out to their families. It was just incredibly unnerving. Madruga, Sterling, and Mathias also regularly used the phone and would have done so from a payphone if there was any type of unexpected diversion from their plans. Family members would drive the highways from Marysville and Yuba City all the way to Chico, searching tirelessly for the five. Melba Madruga would try to report the five missing, but because they were all over the age of 18, as was the police law, they had to wait for 24 hours before they could officially report the men missing and before the police would get involved in the case, which is one of the things that has been criticized throughout this investigation. A report would finally be created on the evening of February 25th at 8 p.m. after Melba Madruga would once again call the Yuba County Sheriff's Department. The families would provide in-depth physical descriptions of the five. They would describe what they were wearing that night and Doc Madruga's car, the light blue Montego. They would also provide the license plate number, and they would explain that the five would have been carrying no more than $10 to $15 on them. Yuba County Sheriff's Department would also notify neighboring counties to be on the lookout for the men. Early articles written about the disappearance of the five stated that the men were, using air quotes, slightly retarded. I said this in part one, but again, not a word in my vocabulary, not a word that I am fond of, but this was the common term back then. It was also an inaccurate label. They were also called slightly disabled or handicapped. These would be common terms in the media to describe the missing men. And remember from part one, none of these men had been formally diagnosed with an intellectual disability aside from Gary Mathias, and his was a mental disability. He had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. The other men had been rubber stamped as disabled because some of them seemed to have a lower IQ or were hyperactive or maybe had difficulty reading. While these terms being printed in the papers may have been used to bring some urgency to the case, like they could have had good intentions, it could have also been significantly damaging. If you think about it, if they would have put five athletes missing in the paper, and this is literally quoting one of the family members, maybe things would have been different as far as how the public would have taken the search. By using terms like retarded, handicapped, disabled, it could have made the public apathetic, especially because the community, even today, has such an inaccurate, large misunderstanding in regards to people with disabilities. At first, investigators speculated the five men could have run into car trouble, or they could have picked up a hitchhiker. And the police were just in the process of developing theories, but the only potential leads they had to go off of for the first few days after the men's disappearance were an influx of very strange sightings. On February 28th, the Sutter County Sheriff's Department would get word of an alleged sighting of the five. A woman had called the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department, claiming to have seen the men at a skating rink in Sacramento. The police thought this could be a promising lead because the men did enjoy being active, and one of the common activities they liked to do was roller skating. The woman had seen the news report on television, and she claimed that she had seen six white males that were possibly retarded, which, what does that even mean? I'm confused. But anyway, another sighting would come from that same day when someone would claim to see a blue Mercury parked at the Metro Airport in Sacramento with its lights on. The person would report this sighting and say that it took place in the early morning hours on Sunday, February 26th. Another sighting would be reported by a security guard who also strangely reported to see six men, similar to the woman's report. And he said that the six men matched the five's description, and they were seen at a Sacramento department store. So both of these sightings were in Sacramento. But these sightings would lead to nowhere. And these are just two sightings. There were many, many, many more outlined in Tony Wright's book. And I'll talk about a couple of more. But definitely read the book if you want to hear more sightings, because it's kind of insane how many sightings there were. So at 7:28 p.m. on Tuesday, February 28th, police would end up locating Madruga's light blue Mercury Montego, and it was abandoned in the Plumas National Forest. A man named Willard Burris, a U.S. forest worker, would be the one to report the car to authorities. And he would later say that the car had been there for several days. It appeared that it had been stuck in the snow, but Burris at first didn't think much of this, because this was actually pretty common in this area. Snow would get bad there, weather would come in, and so people would leave their cars, and sometimes they would also leave their cars to go out snowmobiling or hiking, and then they would come get their cars later. But after the word of the Yuba County 5's disappearance started spreading throughout the area, Burris found out about it and realized that this had to have been Doc Madruga's car. So he called it in. The car was found at Rogers Cow Camp, 4,200 feet above sea level. Reports from the time said that the car was found near some human footprints as well. And the footprints appeared to, according to some reports, be going towards the woods. But we'll talk more about that later. The car would be processed for evidence by police. The men's snack wrappers and empty containers from the snacks they had bought at Bear's Market after the basketball game were found inside, along with a basketball program from the Chico game. The keys for the Montego were also missing, and it was also reported by some people that one of the windows to the Montego was partially rolled down, but this is conflicting in different reports. The car also had a quarter tank of gas left, so a theory, you know, may have been that they ran into car trouble or ran out of gas, but they would find the car had a quarter tank of gas left. It also appeared that the car wasn't damaged, it was functioning properly, so those theories were quickly thrown out. And while the car may have been stuck in snow initially, the car could easily be moved now. Another sighting of the five of note would come from Mary's Country Store in Brownsville, California, but this was nearly 50 miles south of where the car would be found. On Saturday, February 25th, a woman would stop at Mary's Country Store and park next to a red 1953 or 1954 Chevy pickup truck. Remember this car for later. There were two men inside, according to the woman, that appeared to be retarded, which, again, what does that mean? There are several sightings that say this. I saw these men. They seemed to be retarded. What does that look like? You know, it's just ridiculous. She noticed two other people at a phone booth near the store as well. They were using the phone. And the woman was under the impression that one of the individuals at the phone booth was a woman. Also something to remember for later. When the woman who is seeing all of this walked inside of Mary's Country Store, she also noticed a fifth person in one of the aisles that was wearing glasses, but she couldn't provide any other description. This may have been Gary Mathias, if this is even true, because he was the only one who wore glasses. The woman would later identify Ted Weir, Doc Madruga, Bill Sterling, and Hewitt as the men that she saw. I guess she couldn't identify Gary Mathias for some reason. The owner of Mary's Country Store would also confirm, though, seeing Jackie Hewitt and Gary Mathias in the store on Saturday and Sunday buying snacks. They disappeared on Friday night. So if this is true, they were out buying snacks. Why? It's just so odd. She then saw Hewitt and Mathias eating outside of the store. And these are, again, just a few of the dozens of strange sightings that police would have to sift through. Not long after Doc Madruga's Montego would be found, the one man who claimed to have seen the five alive that night, Joseph Schoen, would come forward. Chapter 5, Joseph Schoen. Schoen would claim on the night that the five disappeared, he had been up on that same road as the men at Rogers Cow Camp in his Volkswagen. His car had become stuck in the snow, and when he was trying to get his car out of the snow, he started having severe chest pains. He felt like he was having a heart attack. He would sit in his car for hours. When around 11 p.m., Schoen would notice a light blue two-door Mercury Montego pulling up on the road close by. Schoen would call out for help, but instead of responding to his pleading cries, the individuals would go into the forest. But in the words of Tony Wright, author of Things Aren't Right, quote, "The good news for law enforcement was that they had a witness, and his name was Joseph Schoen's. The bad news for law enforcement was that they had a witness, and his name was Joseph Schoen's," end quote. So, Joseph Harold Schoen's was in his mid-50s at the time that he saw, allegedly, the Yuba County Five. And he lived in Berry Creek area, which is just outside of the Plumas National Forest. Schoen's was known by all who knew him to be a drunk and a compulsive liar. It would be March 1st, 1955, when Schoen's would be arrested for the first time for drunk driving. This would become a pattern, happening at least three more times as far as we know, and that's just the times he was arrested. He would also have several other run-ins with the law for theft, drunk and disorderly conduct, public intoxication, traffic warrants, driving without a license, and misdemeanors. Schoen's had a reputation for being unique, let's say that, and at times unruly, according to his neighbors. Tom McGarry comes up a lot in Tony Wright's book, and he was a neighbor of Joseph Schoen's. So he talked at length about Schoen's and his run-ins with him. So according to Tom McGarry, Schoen's was one of the biggest bullshit artists in the world. According to McGarry, Shones just loved to hear himself talk and was known to tell crazy stories. One example that McGarry would provide was when Shones claimed he stormed the beaches of Guadalcanal, but Shones' military record with the Navy did not show he had any combat experience. He also had been stationed in Iceland at the time that this battle took place, so he was clearly lying. The people of Berry Creek believed Shones to be nothing more than a drunk who made up tall tales. And this is the last person to see these five men alive. What are the chances? Truly. I'm asking. So when Shones would be interviewed by police on March 2nd, he was recuperating at a hospital in Chico from his heart attack, using air quotes, alleged heart attack. We'll talk more about that later. But Shones would say that at 6 p.m. on February 24th, his Volkswagen had gotten stuck, and then he started having this heart attack. After 5 to 6 hours had gone by, Shones would then hear a whistling noise. So he was like, oh my God, people are out here. So he decided to yell and honk his horn, hoping to get help because he's having a heart attack for 5 or 6 hours. When this didn't work, he said that he got out of his car, looked around, and he saw headlights in the distance. Shones would then describe having a dreamlike impression of seeing anywhere from 2 to 12 people, which is a huge difference. I don't know how you mix up seeing 2 to 12 people, but that's what he says. So Shones would yell for help. And when he did, he claimed that the car's lights would shut off and the whistling noises that he was hearing would suddenly stop. Shones would then get back in his car, annoyed that the group was not helping him, and he claimed he would stay in his Volkswagen until 4 a.m. on Saturday, February 25th. He would then psych himself up to take the long walk down the road to go get help, because he's in the middle of nowhere. And it's the 70s, so he can't just use his phone and dial 911. He would notice the headlights to the Montego were on again, so he decided to walk that direction, and he would find the car abandoned. According to Shones, the Montego did not appear to be stuck, and it was also unlocked. Why would he know that? So Shones opened the driver's side door, weird, and he considered resting in the car, but he decided against it because, according to him, there was something strange about the contents of the car that he couldn't quite put his finger on. But he claimed that there were baby clothes and toys in the car. So it's at this point that Joseph Shones, again, according to him, would turn around and walk down the hill 9 miles. 9 miles. To a place called Mountain House, which was basically a restaurant bar area. And this was verified by staff. He did go to Mountain House in the morning. He asked one of the staff members for water and 2 Buferin, which is like an over-the-counter medication that's basically like aspirin and an antacid. Staff also reported putting his hands on his head and saying, "I should have done this 2 years ago." What that means, we have no idea. From there, Joseph Shones would get a ride home. Notice I didn't say hospital. A ride home. And he would go to bed. His daughter and his wife would then arrive home at noon, and then they would go try to get his Volkswagen that he left up in the Plumas. And then, finally, at 6 p.m., he would go to the hospital. So you might notice by my tone of voice, I'm having a hard time buying this story. And the other problem is that his story ends up changing multiple times. According to Tom McGarry, the former neighbor of Shones, Shones was always having a quote-unquote heart attack. It was the excuse that he would use to get people to help him. He would spend his days getting drunk and driving around the area, and then he would basically crash his car. He would get it in a ditch and then he would use this excuse to have people help him get his car out. And McGarry said that he helped Shones get his car out of ditches 5 or 6 times at least. Shones would later tell his wife, a woman named Cindy, that while he was up on the mountain, he not only saw the light blue Montego, but he also saw a rust-colored pickup truck. Remember the pickup truck from Mary's Country Store that the woman claimed to see some of the men inside of? So this could be a coincidence, but I find it strange that this woman reported this pickup truck and said it was red and it was an older model. And then we have Joseph Shones, who, yes, is a liar, but I doubt he made all of this up. And he saw a rust-colored pickup truck up in the Plumas right by the Montego the night that the men disappeared. Either this is a really weird coincidence, or there was a red or rust-colored pickup truck involved in whatever happened to the men. But then, later, Shones would claim that you couldn't rely on him seeing the pickup truck because he was having a heart attack, and this was all a dreamlike impression, so he could have just been hallucinating the truck. And then another thing that bothers me a lot about this is that hospital admission files for Joseph Shones when he went to the hospital for his heart attack have never been released. Yeah. Like, what? So we don't actually know why Joseph Shones went to the hospital. We know that he stayed there for a couple of days, but we don't know if he had a heart attack or if that was a bullshit story. The other big question is, why was Joseph Shones up in the Plumas in the first place? It's pitch black, the roads are treacherous and dangerous, the road is covered in snow. Why were you up there, Joseph? And that's where his story changed multiple times. So at first, Shones would tell police that he and his family were basically vacationing in this area, and he had stopped at a bar to get a beer, then he drove to Mountain House and had another beer, and then somewhere between 5:30 and 6, he decided to leave to go check the snow line. So he drove to a spot where he knew his family could have fun in the snow. I don't know. But then he got onto the road near Roger's cow camp and his car lost traction and got stuck. Then he said he managed to move the car 12 feet, weirdly specific, before he got sick. And he said he vomited and defecated multiple times. And then he tried to get back in his car to warm himself up. He would leave the car multiple times to vomit and defecate, and hours would pass before the Montego would show up. Then he noticed the rust-colored pickup truck behind the Montego, and he would see all of those people exit the Montego and get into the pickup truck before driving away. So then Shones starts going to the media and talking about what he saw. He would tell the Oroville Mercury Register that he was up there that night because he just wanted to see the snow. So first it was because he was like drunk and driving around and then his car just got stuck. Then it was because he was checking the snow line and his family was vacationing up there. And then it was, I just want to see the snow. Another time he would say he was going up there specifically to check on his cabin, but investigators would find that his cabin was actually 14 miles north of where he was, and he would have to have taken a completely different route to get there. He would also claim he got into Madruga's vehicle later on to rest in the front seat. He told this to the Oroville Mercury Register. So when he talked to police and the hospital initially, he said that he thought about resting in the car, but saw something was off and decided not to. And then he later tells the media that he did get in the car and he did rest. So just multiple inconsistencies in his story. Shones would also later tell the Appeal Democrat he only looked inside of the vehicle. Just keeps changing. He would also lie to the press about what he did for a living. He told them that he was a rehabilitative therapist. not true at all. He didn't even, like, work in mental health or therapy of any kind. And the other weird thing is when he went to Mountain House, and this would be verified by staff, he never mentioned that he was having a heart attack. And then when he's getting a ride home, he never mentions a heart attack. He did mention he was having chest pains, but that's it. He just asked them to take him home. Just doesn't make any sense. Sean's car would also be found later to have been out of gas with a dead battery. And when he was pressed by police for more details, according to them, his demeanor would change. At first, he was like really open and just yapping and talking. And it seemed that police weren't buying his story, and maybe Shones caught on to that. So he kind of cowered and got closed off. And according to one of the detectives, Shones said, quote, "I get the feeling you guys think I know something about these dudes," end quote. Yeah, of course they think that. Like, you were there. So it's just weird. His demeanor in the hospital was also very odd while he was recovering from whatever happened to him. He was crying constantly and uncontrollably for days. So one of the big mysteries about this case is, why did Joseph Shones lie? Was it intentional? Was it for attention in the media? Is he having trouble stringing together a cohesive story because he was drunk? Or did he have something to do with what happened to the Yuba County Five? And what are the odds that Shones ended up on the same road as the five men? An abandoned road in the middle of 1 million acres of forest. We do know that at one point Shones was asked to take a polygraph, and police were denied this request by Shones' doctor because the doctor claimed it would be too stressful for him and it could cause another quote-unquote heart attack. The doctor didn't want to put Shones in a situation that was overtly stressful, and police are like, okay, and they're trying to compromise, so they came up with an alternative. They were like, okay, if Shones can't take a polygraph, what if we could hypnotize him, and maybe this would help him remember more about that night? And once again, the doctor would deny this request, because according to the doctor, having Shones mentally retrace what happened that night could be too stressful for him. So Joseph Shones would continue after this to live in Berry Creek area throughout the 80s, and his neighbor, Tom McGarry, would recall some incidents that would happen with Shones. Apparently, Shones was involved in illegal growing of marijuana. And in 1982, an intoxicated Shones would drive up to the property that McGarry was staying at. He was staying there with, like, some family members. And according to McGarry, Shones was very agitated at them. He was, like, yelling at them. And when he got out of the car, one of McGarry's family members would end up shoving Shones onto the ground. And Shones would just kind of storm off, drive away back to his home. And then from his home, because he kind of lives up on this hill, he would pull a rifle and start shooting at the residence that McGarry was staying at. So they would call police, and when police would get there, for whatever reason, they ended up not arresting anybody. So you pull out a gun and you start shooting at people and you don't get arrested. I don't understand how that works. Weird. During the shooting, McGarry also grabbed his rifle, and he had Joseph Shones in his scope and said he was fully prepared to shoot him, but his friend talked him out of it. The Shones shooting story would also be corroborated by other individuals that were in the vicinity that day, so something definitely went down. Before we get into chapter 6, I'm gonna take a quick break.
All right, I think I hacked in.
We're on the air?
Shh, security's outside.
But how's my hair?
It's a radio station.
Psst, psst. You guys hear about the Beyond the Shadows podcast with Ryan and Scott?
You guys into paranormal?
What about true crime?
How about UFOs and cryptids?
We also have mad hauntings.
We got security.
No, we don't. We're not big enough to need it yet.
No, we got security.
Hey, what are you guys doing? Get out of here! Listen to the Beyond the Shadows podcast.
Beyond the Shadows.
I would like to briefly interrupt this episode to let everyone know that I had the honor of being on the Uncomfortable podcast with Eric Zalagi. For those of you who may not be familiar, Eric hosts an interview-style paranormal and cryptids-related encounters podcast, and he interviewed me at length, and I shared several encounters on there, including ones that I've never talked about on this podcast or to really anybody for that matter. So check me out on Uncomfortable and show Eric some love wherever you get your podcasts. Tell them Perplexity sent you. It is a great show and I think you'll enjoy it. And now let's hear from Eric.
If tales of ghostly hauntings, Bigfoot encounters, extraterrestrial interactions, and cosmic awakenings are your cup of tea, then join me, Eric Szilagyi, host of Uncomfortable Podcast, every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Make Uncomfortable your home for the topics that reside on the fringe of our reality. Eyewitnesses, researchers, and experiencers join me on a weekly basis to delve into their paranormal and otherworldly experiences. Heard in over 65 countries worldwide, follow Uncomfortable Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your casts. Uncomfortable is now presented in video form on YouTube as well. So, as always, my friends, stay uncomfortable.
Now back to the show.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
Chapter 6, March 1978. Doc Madruga's Montego would continue to be processed for evidence. Of note, a map of California would be found in the front seat of the Montego, with a bunch of X's marked at various locations, along with handwritten notes. It would later be found that the map belonged to Bill Sterling, And the maps would not shed any light, unfortunately, on any clues regarding the disappearance of the five. It seemed like the markings were just places that were special to Bill Sterling. Like, I think his church was on there and some other jobs that he had had. There were also no signs of foul play in the vehicle. There was no blood or anything like that. And meanwhile, search teams would continue to look all throughout the Plumas National Forest for the five missing men. They searched using a grid system. There were a lot of volunteers involved in the search as well. The search basically started at where the Montego was found, and then they spread out. And if you remember earlier, I mentioned there were several sets of footprints found near the Montego. And some reports said the footprints appeared to be walking into the woods. But other sources I read said that the footprints appeared to have been made by the group, but they were melted. With the snow melting, how could investigators tell if the footprints were going away or towards the Montego? If they were going towards the Montego, the footprints could have been made by another group, perhaps. And unfortunately, and I feel like this happens in so many disappearance cases, the weather would significantly impact the search. This would be a big hindrance in the investigation. 2 feet of snow would fall from March 2nd to March 3rd, halting the rescue efforts, and snow would continue to fall throughout all of early March. And this would result in at least 6 feet of snow and really high snow drifts. So while this was going on and the search couldn't be happening, police looked to other ways to be investigating. So a proposal was made by the Madruga family to get the help from a psychic named Dr. Gloria Elizabeth Daniel. Daniel would report a man appearing to her in a vision that had suffered a massive heart attack with sandy colored hair. She believed this to be Ted Weir. Daniel would also explain the car had been driven to the Plumas not by Doc Madruga, but by someone else. She also claimed that she had a vision of a red pickup truck, a prediction made before this was in the papers. She also felt the strong presence of a woman. So now we have multiple reports of a red pickup truck and someone who appeared to be a woman being seen with the men. Very eerie and strange. She also claimed that she had a vision of another man who would show Daniel the area where the men had disappeared. The man appeared to be in a state of shock. He was crying. And then Daniels claimed that she was having this vision of an abandoned cabin, and the cabin would be east of where the car was found. The young man kept repeating March 15th over and over. Daniel felt that whatever had happened to the men was not good. She also believed that the five had helped a woman and that this is what led to their doom. Daniel would also go on to tell the family that the five men were not in the area that the police were searching. They needed to search a different area. She also said that the five would be found together for the most part, but one man would be separated from the group. And this is very eerie. Everything that Daniels is saying, it's pretty creepy considering what I know the police would find later. She also mentioned something would be shoved in the back seat of the Montego that had not been found, and that this was a link to the person that they helped the night they went missing. Daniel would also have several more visions, including a vision of a man in a Western hat with some type of connection to the state of Nebraska. She also saw turquoise jewelry, and the man in the vision she had seen with the sandy hair that she thought was Ted Weir. The sandy-haired man in this vision would refer to the man in the cowboy hat as being a bastard. She also saw two of the missing men holding one another, freezing and crying. And another vision of some of the men that she saw was them in green bags of some sort. I don't know if they were sleeping bags or body bags or what. But after Daniel would help the police, it seems that this would bring a slew of quote-unquote psychics out of the woodwork. And there are definitely some legit psychics, but a lot of them are fakes and scammers, and they take advantage of desperate families. So one psychic claimed that the five were dead as a result of hanging and that they never left Chico. Pretty insane to say that all five of them hung themselves. Another claimed to have experienced telepathic contact with the men and was certain that all five had perished. They had some sort of vision of a cabin also, and that this was at the end of February, that they were having this vision from like that time period. They were also certain that the five were the ones that were seen at Mary's Country Store, and that one of the five was sick. She also claimed to see water or a filtration plant and green machinery with pumps and fast-flowing water, along with dishes and cups in a variety of colors, and stated that those items would be in the cabin or in a museum near where the men were located. Other psychics would write letters and make phone calls to the families. Wild theories were being thrown around, like the men had been kidnapped, they had run off and joined some type of hippie commune. The police and the families of the five, meanwhile, would continue their search all over the state. And at one point, Kathy Madruga and a few other family members would decide to investigate Forbestown. There was this rumor going around that the five men had gone to Forbestown to stay with one of Gary Mathias's friends. So not really knowing what else to do and running out of leads, Kathy Madruga would go to Forbestown. They would arrive at this home in the mountains that was believed to be the home of one of Gary Mathias's friends, but Kathy Madruga would quickly be filled with regret. So according to Kathy, this house was booby-trapped. She then claimed that men with rifles came out, so she got scared and fled the scene. And she reported this to the sheriff's office, but they would tell Kathy nothing was up there and that they had already searched that area on horseback. So Kathy is like, how did you search that area if it's booby-trapped? And according to Kathy, the police had no explanation for this. One psychic that would help further with the investigation was a woman named Marianne Elko, who had a history of helping the FBI with other cases. She claimed that the men had been followed the night they went missing, and the incident may have started in Oroville, which, if I'm not mistaken, that's the area that kind of forks off on the highway. And it's believed that Madruga took a highway through Oroville that eventually led them to the Plumas. I think I'm remembering that correctly. Elko would then say that the five men were very nervous, and this caused Madruga to accidentally make some wrong turns, and this led them into the Plumas. The men were later forced out of the car and placed in the back of a pickup truck, and then they were bound, and the truck drove northeast from the car. She would also tell police that one of the men was dumped in a body of water. And something else I want to include, because it's very interesting and it's a little Easter egg from part one, during Elko's conversation with police, Lance Ayers, one of the detectives, made some very interesting comments. So when Elko asked Ayers if there was a connection between the disappearance of the five men and the series of fire attacks on Gateway Projects, Ayers would say that there was not a connection, but law enforcement knew who killed Gateway's executive director, Donald Garrett. Remember the man who was set on fire? So Ayers is just publicly saying to people that they know who did it, similar to the statements that were made in the media by, I think his name was Hansen. Ayers would also say that Garrett had angered an individual and that this was their form of retaliating. So not to get too off track here, because I know this doesn't really have anything to do necessarily with the story, but it's gonna come back into part three later when we're talking about theories. And this points pretty clearly to police knowing what happened in the fires and not doing anything to arrest the person who was responsible. So this is suspicious and concerning because this is the group of police that are investigating the Yuba County Five's disappearance. Elko believed that the five who went missing had something to do with what happened with Gateway Projects. And she said that whatever happened to the five, they went missing because Gateway had a horrible negative manifestation of sin. So I don't know if that's an allegation that Gateway was doing some bad shit and someone retaliated to anyone even having ties to Gateway or what that means, but it's not good. So north of where Doc Madruga's Montego had been abandoned, police would also find four strips of gold orange cloth, and these were tied to trees near Soapstone Hill. And the ties seemed to be marking some type of trail. The cloth would later be examined, and it looked weathered, but not like it had been out there for a long period of time. Also found were footprints that led into the canyon near Soapstone Hill. The footprints also led to an abandoned set of cabins that were searched, but no evidence of the men was found. The search team would continue to follow the tracks as they led further towards the canyon, but they eventually lost them. Scent dogs would also be involved in the search, but they would never be able to pick up a scent for any of the missing men. But if that psychic, Daniel, was correct, and they're searching the wrong area, it would make sense that the scent dogs couldn't pick up a scent. Also, there was a lot of snow. I feel like that could make it harder to pick up a scent. So ultimately, the search for the five would end up being called off by police in late March 1978, and the case would go cold, like the below-freezing temperatures in the Plumas. The families of the five would be grieving, angry, and left very confused. Chapter 7, June 1978. After over 3 months had passed since Matthias, Hewitt, Sterling, Madruga, and Weir had vanished, it would be Sunday on June 4th in the morning that Lauren Koch and his 16-year-old son, Roger, would head out for a ride on their motorcycles. They decided to take a scenic route through the Plumas National Forest. Around 8:30 in the morning, the Koch family would come upon a section of road with about 4 feet of snowdrifts. Seeing no way around the snowdrifts, they had to take another route, and this would lead them to a deserted campground called Daniel Zink. And at the Daniel Zink campground, the family would notice the horrific smell of death. The smell would lead them to two side-by-side Forest Service trailers, and Roger Koch would smell that stench. He would follow it to a trailer where he noticed a broken window, and this led him to look inside of the trailer. Inside of the trailer, Roger noticed it was dark and dirty. There were also bunk beds and a lot of dirty dishes, which I find interesting because one of the psychics said there would be a lot of dishes and cups found. And two of the psychics talked about cabins. I feel like a cabin could be easily confused with a trailer. So according to Roger, on the bottom bunk, right next to the window, just mere inches from him, there would be a badly decomposed body covered in a sheet about up to the neck area. So Roger and his family would get back to civilization, call police, and they would come out. They would notice that the deceased was wrapped under about 8 bed sheets. It appeared they were trying to keep warm. And the deceased was wearing the same clothing that Ted Weir was wearing the night that he disappeared. But there was a massive weight loss if this was Ted Weir. The deceased also had a full beard, curly and unkempt hair, And when Ted Weir went missing, he was clean shaven and had short hair, and he was obviously a much bigger guy. So if this was Ted Weir, he had been alive for a pretty significant amount of time after he went missing. Police would also take notice that the deceased had very badly frostbitten feet. Three toes were missing from the right foot and two toes were missing from the left, which would have made walking incredibly painful. And there was a gangrenous infection on the man's legs. There seemed to have been some sort of blood poisoning. And then it was at this point that Ted Weir's ID would be found next to the bed, along with a ring with the name Ted engraved into it, and some other jewelry that Ted had been wearing the night he vanished. There was also, interesting here, a wristwatch in the cabin, but the wristwatch was later confirmed to not belong to Ted Weir, so maybe it belonged to one of the other five men. When police started looking through the trailer, they also noticed that the window had been broken from the outside, so maybe this was a way to break into the trailer. There were also a bunch of empty sea ration cans, and in order to open these sea rations, a church-style key can opener would have had to have been used. It also appeared that one can had been opened with a P-38, which is a small military-style can opener, and you would have had to have had some type of military background or someone with a military background to show you how to use this can opener. So police theorized maybe Madruga or Matthias had used the P-38 can opener to get some food, because Madruga and Matthias had both served in the military. Jackie Hewitt, though, had also gone camping a lot with his dad, and Hewitt Sr. had military experience, so it's possible that Hewitt also could have been the one to open this can. There was also a candle found in the trailer that had been lit at some point, but one of the big mysteries here is there were no other attempts to get warm or start a fire, as far as what police found. There were matches in the trailer, there were heating cans, there was coal oil, heating stoves, and all of these things had been left untouched. There was also a significant supply of dehydrated food that had been left untouched, and this food would have kept the men alive for at least another month. In the corner of the trailer, police would also find a pair of tennis shoes, and these did not belong to Ted Weir. These would later be found to belong to Gary Matthias. Ted Weir's leather suede shoes that he had been wearing when he went missing were nowhere to be found. So police would eventually examine this deceased man's body, and it would later be identified as Ted Weir. Ted, it was estimated, had been alive for somewhere between 8 to 13 weeks since he had disappeared, which is so heartbreaking because that would mean that he was alive while police, volunteers, and family were in those same mountains searching for him. His cause of death was determined to be pulmonary congestion due to exposure. This can be caused by a buildup of fluid in the lungs. It can also be linked to heart problems or trauma to the chest wall, traveling at high elevation. And there were no signs of trauma to the chest wall or any foul play. So it seemed that Ted Weir died because of exposure. According to Dorothy Weir Dornan, Ted's sister, the forest rangers had told the sheriff in Oroville that they would check these exact trailers. But when they asked the sheriff, because they had to get permission to go up there, the sheriff would say, and this is alleged, but according to Dorothy, the sheriff would say, quote, "Nah, they're retarded. They would never make it up there," end quote. So if that's the case, they would be responsible for Ted Weir not being found alive. The sheriff would be responsible. And Dorothy believes that if they had checked these trailers at Daniel Zink Campground around the time that they had planned to search them, they could have saved Ted Weir's life and possibly some of the other men who may have been at this trailer. But according to Butte County Undersheriff Richard Stenberg, no one involved in the search had been made aware by forest rangers of the trailers. So it's like they're blaming each other. All three jurisdictions would also later claim they found out about the trailers after Ted Weir's body was found. So it's hard to really say what happened here, but nevertheless, it's pretty heartbreaking that they were searching these same areas and Ted Weir, you know, wasn't far up in this cabin. 2 days after the discovery of Weir's remains, police would find Jack Madruga and Bill Sterling's remains. Madruga and Sterling's remains would be found in the Granite Basin or Basin area, about 3 miles from where Weir had been found. Madruga was badly decomposed, similar to Weir. He was clutching a watch, and his remains appeared to have been picked at by animals. The keys to his Montego were also found with him. Sterling was close by Madruga, just across the road in an embankment. Animals had scattered his remains, and Sterling was wearing the same clothes that he was the night he went missing. His wallet was also found on him with pictures of his sisters and his social security card. The discovery of Madruga's body had been anticipated by Kathy as well. She had a feeling that this would happen. Kathy was Madruga's niece. She had an experience one night where she was sleeping in Doc's room. I guess she missed him. And she claimed that she was woken up in the middle of the night because she heard a man crying, and she heard the sound of pages, like pages of paper, being rustled together. She then felt the weight of a body on the side of the bed, and she told Doc that he could have his room back. So she sensed that it was Doc in the room with her. She would later have a dream that night that she and Doc's mom, Melba Madruga, were sitting in the front room making lunch when they would hear a car pull up, and this would be the sheriff's department. And Kathy remembered in this dream, she was holding a can of Coors Light beer, which was weird because she never drank canned beer or Coors Light. But in real life, it would later be lunchtime on June 6th when Kathy would make Melba lunch. And Kathy would open, for some reason, a can of Coors Light beer. And right after she opened the can of beer, a Yuba County Sheriff's Department officer would interrupt them, knock on the door, and the second that the officer knocked on the door, Kathy became emotional because she knew that this was going to be them getting the news that they had found Madruga's body. Madruga and Sterling's remains would later be examined, and while it was difficult to determine the cause of death due to the advanced state of decomposition that both of the men were in, there was no evidence of foul play. It was very shocking to investigators that they found the men where they did, because this would have been a 15-mile treacherous walk from where the Montego had been found. There's rough terrain. There were 4 to 8 feet of snow estimated to be on the ground as well at the time that the men were out in these elements. And investigators were also having a hard time making sense of how the men went from the car to the trailer because the road did not directly connect the two locations. The trailers were also incredibly hidden and hard to find. So they would describe it as like them finding these trailers was like a needle in a haystack. The next day, Jackie Hewitt's father would return to the same area to search for his son's remains. He would spot his son Jackie's jacket, the one he was wearing the night he went missing. So Jackie's father would go to the jacket, and when he went to pick up the jacket, Jackie's spine would fall out. The rest of Jackie's remains had been scattered, likely by animals, across the forest floor. Jackie's skull would later be found about 100 yards away from the rest of his remains. And Jackie's remains would later be positively identified as being his through the help of Jackie's dentist. They would use dental records. But Jackie's dentist did have some discrepancies against the confirmation because Jackie had apparently had a lot of dental work done. So he said it was probably him, but he couldn't fully confirm it. And when Hewitt Sr., Jackie's father, would find his son's remains, he had actually stopped smoking. He was free of smoking cigarettes for the last several years, but when he found him that day, he would smoke 2 packs of cigarettes. And this is so heartbreaking. Later that day, he would return home to find his wife, Sarah, who was clearly ill, and he could not get her to wake up. He would later find a note that Sarah had written to him saying that she couldn't take this anymore. And he would rush her to the doctor. It wasn't clear what had happened or what she had taken, but it seemed this was an attempt to kill herself, but she would survive this incident. Hewitt Sr. would also tell the investigators and tell the media that he felt the investigation had been mishandled. It seemed that the men had been blamed by the media too, for getting lost based on their quote unquote intellectual disabilities. Ted Weir, Doc Madruga, Bill Sterling, and Jackie Hewitt's remains had all been found at this point. But what about Gary Mathias? And this is the thing, Gary Mathias's remains would never be found. They still have not been found to this day. And going back to part one, with Gary Mathias's history of survival experience, running away, and being able to walk for incredibly long distances, a question here. Is it possible Gary Mathias made it out of the Plumas alive? In May of 1979, police would receive a call from San Joaquin, California. A man named Paul Morris, which is a pseudonym, claimed to have seen a man hitchhiking. The man would match this description to the description of Gary Mathias. He claimed to see Mathias get into a pickup truck. Weird. He wrote down the license plate and he gave it to officers. The Yuba County Sheriff's Department then reported that San Joaquin Sheriff's Department said they would follow up on this and they would track down the owner of the pickup truck because, after all, they have the license plate number. But no additional information was provided in the case files. So another very frustrating thing. We don't know what happened here. In the late 1970s or early 80s, Kathy Madruga, Jack Madruga's niece, stopped by a bar owned by her mother in Browns Valley, and she claimed that inside she saw a guy sitting at the end of a bar, and he looked at Kathy. He made eye contact with her. She claims, and she says this with 100% certainty, that this was Gary Mathias. Kathy, once she sees quote-unquote Gary, turns to go notify her mother, and she claimed that when she would go to tell her mother this, the man would run out the door. Kathy would later pick Mathias out of a photo lineup 10 times. She then claimed one of the officers told her she wasn't the only one who had claimed to see Gary Mathias. According to Kathy, this officer said someone had also seen Mathias at a Denny's restaurant, at Montgomery Ward Department Store, and at a 7-Eleven. However, when author Tony Wright went through the Yuba County's case files, the only sighting of Mathias that he found that was documented was the hitchhiking sighting by Paul Morris. None of the other sightings were in the files. So at the beginning of this episode and the beginning of this series, I emphasized that the more I learned about this case, the more confused and uncertain I became. Do you see what I mean now? This case is so bizarre and unsettling. And it's so heartbreaking that five men would all vanish unexpectedly in the same night, and their families would have to process and grieve all of this together. The disappearances also happened at a time that the community of Yuba City had already been rocked with multiple tragedies. Murders at the hands of a serial killer, tragic accidents, fires, bomb threats, and there was a high level of crime going on. The men were young, with so much to look forward to. And for their lives to end in the middle of nowhere, in the freezing cold, it's just horrifying. It makes no sense. But nevertheless, there are many theories as to what happened to the Yuba County Five. And we will get into those next week, where we will conclude this three-part deep dive. Be sure to tune in next week for part three, which will conclude this perplexing series. In part three, we will wrap everything up. We will dive into some crazy theories. And I want to thank Scott once again, a patron, a member of the Perplexed Society, for making this request. That is one of the benefits of joining the Perplexed Society. If you make a request, it goes to the front of the queue. And I love when you guys make requests. It lets me know that you're listening and engaged, and I love it so much. So thank you again to Scott. If you want to support the show, as I do not qualify for any type of monetization, you can join the Patreon. You can become a Perplexity supporter for $1 a month, which has some perks, or you can join the Perplexed Society for $3 a month, where you get a lot of perks, including exclusive bonus content. And if you enjoyed this episode and you are watching on YouTube, I would love if you let me know. Hit that subscribe button, leave a comment down below. Let me know what your theories are. I'm curious what they are as we get into part three next week. If you are listening on a podcast platform, I would love it so much if you left me a 5-star review, because each time you do that, it puts me in front of other listeners. It really, really helps the show. You can also write a review if you're listening on Apple Podcasts. You can leave a review like this one from Anger Management SMD. Love the show. So glad I found this show. Love listening on my long drives to work. It makes the time fly. Keep doing what you're doing. I also want to remind everyone that I am compiling some questions, because at some point in 2024, I'm going to do a live Q&A. So send me any questions, anything you want to know about me, and I will be happy to answer those in the live Q&A. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week and stay safe. I hope you tune in next week for part three, and I will talk to you soon. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Perplexity, a mystery podcast, hosted, written, and produced by Kadra Brennan. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell the world about it by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leaving a 5-star review. It helps the show more than you know. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And if you have a story to share or a topic request, send an email to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Kadra would love to read your story on the podcast. Until next week, stay curious. Thank you for listening to Perplexity, a mystery podcast, hosted, written, and produced by Kadra Brennan. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell the world about it by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leaving a 5-star review. It helps the show more than you know. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And if you have a story to share or a topic request, send an email to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Kadra would love to read your story on the podcast. Until next week, stay curious.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That 2-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Menards 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors, the bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams, save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details.
Save big money at
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.